James O'Mara, Rabbit, and Alex von Goldstein for part two of our show on his book, Green Nazis in Outer Space. On our last show, we kind of went off on a lot of different tangents. We covered a lot of really interesting material, but not all of it was in the book. But with James's work, you can take like one topic and it can just explode into all these other topics, and that can produce like an hour-long show. So great having you guys back on.
It's been a while.
Good to be here. So what else are people interested in the book?
Well,
Green Nazis from Space, my third or fourth book, depending on how you count the book on Mad Men, which was one of my own productions.
Which one thing I thought was interesting was the discussion of like Judeo influence on comics.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read Bowden's book Pulp Fascism, which I think that explores like the opposite themes in comics that are a different kind of far right themes in comics. I haven't read it personally, but it immediately came to mind as something that might be relevant.
It probably is. I have that book, and I have read some of that book. I don't. I know what you're talking about. That theme. I probably was trying to deliberately carry on that idea. But on the other hand, I can't think that anything I actually read of his that particularly influenced me, other than the general notion that there are, what would be called fascist themes in comic books. You know, the official story is that comic books were invented by the Jews, and Superman is the crypto-Jew, has a secret identity and changes his name, and he comes from an alien place. And, as a historical fact, Jews, of course, because they were involved in publishing in New York and so on, were involved in the creation of these comic books. But that also these sort of like Judaic themes would necessarily creep in. That's the official story, and that's the story the Jews themselves tell. There have been several books written about that. I think there's one called, I can't think of the name, it's like From Jerusalem to Krypton or something like that. So they're happy to promote that idea. In the title essay of Green Nazis from Space, is it like a review of the Green Lantern movie? And I thought the Green Lantern movie was interesting more for the reaction to it, because people hated it. And there was a review on somewhere that was titled Douchebag in Space, I think was the and it probably inspired my own title actually.
Yeah, I noticed that you quoted a bunch of different reviews in the chapter.
Yeah, they people seem to really hate this movie for some reason, and it seemed to me when I saw it on cable, because I don't go out to the movies, they're expensive and you have to be with other people and stuff like that, and it's just no good. So
yeah,
I hate
listening to people eat in the movie theater. That's like a major pet peeve of mine. It's totally just disgusting. Like,
well, the nice thing about going to the movies is no one's there.
Well, well, actually, if you had gone to see Green Lantern, there would have been no one there, actually. Because it was a bomb. It was a dud. I talk a little bit about, you know, there's these various kinds of, you know, you have Superman, who, of course, has superpowers, and he was never interesting to me. I was never interested in Superman. Except when you're a young kid, you read everything, you know. So, I mean, if the Superman comic appeared, I'd read it. And this is the point I make. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I mean, there was DC Comics, and this was the silver age of DC Comics, you know. So Superman was an upright American citizen and saluted the flag and stuff like that. You know, of course, we're supposed to regard that as campy and propagandistic today and so on. And there was Batman. Now, Batman, you see, Superman is just a guy who has superpowers. Duh. You know, he's like the Jew who finds himself in our world, and he has to hide his name, but he's smarter than everyone. He was not interesting to me because he was invulnerable, and he did nothing to achieve his powers. He literally was a child, an infant. He's just sent to a place with a yellow sun. Batman is more interesting because he's basically a crazed vigilante. But he makes himself into the Batman. You know, he has to train himself in various ways. Of course, it helps if you're a billionaire. So
What do you?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what do you make of Robert Crumb's comics? He had dealt with a lot of very racially insensitive, you know, comics. And I mean, he has one like a comic that's. You know, when the niggers take over the world or something, and they're all kind of couched in, and then there's another one, you know, when the goddamn Jews take over the world. They're all kind of couched in this satirical irony, but he would still like, you know, he would never get away with that shit, I don't think, even as a form of satire. So it's sometimes when you read comics like that, like, it's tough to tell what he's actually. You know, what he's saying, or even if he's saying it satirically, it still has sometimes some truth in it, even if they're trying to. You see that a lot in films or books when they're trying to make fun of something, but it actually makes it come off appealing. You see that with kind of some of these Nazi movies or something, which are meant to make the Nazis look horrible, but really are people like, wow, they look cool, you know, or something like that.
That topic kind of goes back to your essay on a sartorical fascism, because you talk about kind of uniforms. I think there is kind of a fetishization of a Nazism and fascism. Part of it has to do with the uniforms. You also talk about American uniforms and how they military uniforms have become like purely utilitarian.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the general. Make a general point here that this is. See, this is the reason why political correctness exists as a code, and that's why it's so important to people. Because what's called fascism is natural, you know. And this gets back to the other point, you know. I mean, what we're talking about is the way things naturally are. You know, I mean, I don't want to fetishize the idea of nature like I'm some sort of, you know, might makes right kind of guy or Darwinism or something. I'm just talking about, you know, just natural common sense. And everything else is some kind of unnatural ideology that has to be imposed on them. And you can't let them think for themselves because they might stray off the reservation. That's why it's so important to police thought. The left is only interested in freedom of thought as long as they're in the minority. And then when they take power, they clamp down. Because you can't have people thinking for themselves, because they might think bad things. So Nazism has to be the greatest taboo we have, because it's the most attractive thing. Was it Woody Allen or Edmund White or somebody who said that, you know, nobody has a sexual fantasy about being tied up and tortured by a liberal. And I think it was Edmund White who said that you know, S&M, you know, revolves around Nazis and leather and things like that. And why not? What else would it revolve around? Button-down shirts and Oxfords or something like that? But yeah, I mean, there's a certain, as it were, naturalness about that kind of fetishism. I mean, somebody said that they had a fetish for Oxford shirts, button-down shirts, Oxford cloth button-down shirts. That would be deemed weird, even apart from it being a fetish, right? Be weird as a fetish. There's other things that seem natural. But I don't want to talk about fetishism so much. I mean, it's just like the natural appeal of it. I mean, it's a natural system. Like, you know, well, why shouldn't we have a border? Why shouldn't we decide who comes in and out of our country? That's natural. So that has to be demonized, announced, and you're told you're stupid and you're a Nazi and so on, etc. But wait a second, isn't that the way America operated prior to 1965? Things weren't so bad then. Oh, well, of course, those were the terrible little days anyway. But, we'll talk about that. There's a certain natural attraction of these ideas because they are, in fact, natural. To get back to the comic books and B-movies and the sort of stuff that I look at are of interest because that's what happened. It Kissed Me Deadly, for instance, in my previous movie, The Elder Devlin. This is a movie that the director, Robert Aldrich, and the screenwriter set out to destroy Mike Hammer. They despised Mike Hammer. They thought Mike Hammer was, you know, like Donald Trump or Ronald Reagan. He was this evil fascist that people were infatuated with, and they had to be taught he was a bad man. They shouldn't approve of Mike Hammer. So they made this movie, Kiss Me Deadly. And the strange thing was is that by showing how brutal and sadistic and crazed Mike Hammer was, first of all, they made a movie that was decently condemned. So they were in a position of like the Nice Report on Pornography, where the report itself was pornographic.
No. That's kind of like Tony Soprano is meant to be this sort of bad guy on The Sopranos, but he's the guy who everyone ends up liking.
Exactly.
And you could make the same thing for Donald Trump. It's like when people are allowed to, when people see someone confidently acting, quote unquote, the way you're not supposed to act, everyone just loves that person.
Right, or like how Joe Pesci like steals the show in Goodfellas because he's the one who's like, he's the one who's most like raw and unauthentic in the film.
Well, you went too far there, because he's really a psychopath.
Well, he is, but he's the one who really he's the most like all of his lines.
He's the most memorable.
He's the most memorable, and he's like I think kind of the a lot of the defining people who like the film. That's what really stands out.
They always remember.
Character.
Yeah, I mean, I have to make a point about Joe Pesci. I mean, that Pesci's character, something people miss about Joe Pesci's character in Goodfellas. This relates to Orlando and Gun Control in general and so on, and this relates to Mike Hammer too, because in the Hammer films and in the books that I've read so much. So few of them, a couple of them. Mickey Spillane is very precise about guns. When he made his own movie, The Girl Hunter, he was making it in England, so it was hard to find guns. But he had fans in the underworld, so they gave him guns. So he had like authentic 45s, Colt 38s, and so on all through the movie. And he was always very, very careful about showing how some people had permits and so on, etc. Bottom line is this, that in New York, there's something called the Sullivan Act. And if you were on the street without a permit for a gun, you go to prison. And this has nothing to do with Giuliani or liberals or anything like that. This is just a fact since 1930.
I know in New York, when you had the Bernie Goetz incident, he was not charged for the actual event itself, but I think he did go to jail for possessing a gun illegally.
Exactly, because you can't plead that out. There's no way to get around it. No one will do anything for you. You can sail on everything else, shooting the people, doing this, that, and the other thing, stealing the money, but the gun will put you in prison. And Mickey Spillane, even in in the Mike Hammer books. He's always very careful about it. Sometimes he has a license, sometimes he doesn't have a license. Doesn't have a license, he has to use his fist, you know? But he's very careful about it. Part of the authenticity of the books. Anyway, my point is, no gangster, no real gangster goes around with a gun. And Joe Pesci in Goodfellas goes around with a gun. And you see him in that classic scene about What's So Funny About Me? And he pulls out his gun. That's supposed to link to a later scene in the movie where he's gambling, and then speaking of Sopranos, the guy who plays Spider, who was later in the Sopranos, he's the little kid who's the waiter, and Pesci gets angry with him, and he pulls out his gun and shoots him. And he comes back later, tells him to go fuck himself, and he shoots him again, and this time kills him. That is what gets him whacked in the movie, because that shows that he's a psychopath, and they won't tolerate him, because he's carrying around a gun, he could get popped at any point, and he's prone to pull it out, as he does all the time, and eventually when he shoots Spider, he shoots Spider. So the whole point of that characterization is to show that he's crazy, even by gangster standards.
You have a chapter in your book on Kafka, and you title it Kafka, Our Folk Comrade. Do you get into his work, or do you mostly just talk about him as a person? He's sort of known for writing about themes like alienation and bureaucracy, but his work is in a very kind of a very abstract, almost like dreamlike style.
Well, I am in that essay more interested in his person, and particularly in his reputation, how it was constructed, and I'm sort of basing myself on recent biographical stuff about Kafka. That establishes that Kafka was basically just a normal guy. He wasn't a tortured, he was a genius, but he wasn't a tortured genius living in an attic predicting the Holocaust. And that he was a normal guy. He was a yuppie, is what I say. He was an Austrian yuppie, and he had a perfectly good job. He lived with his parents, but his parents lived in a large apartment house. He lived with his parents because he was cheap, saving money. He was well paid. He had plenty of vacations. He got along with his boss. He wrote at night because he said he was too lazy to write during the day, not forced to or anything like that. And all those tormented works and so on were actually supposed to be funny. They were jokes. When he read the opening of the Metamorphosis to his gathering of his friends, everyone including Kafka broke down in laughter. This whole image of Kafka is this, when he wasn't ignored during his lifetime, he was actually among the cream of literary set, well known in Berlin, published by all the leading publishing houses and so on. He was no hidden or forgotten genius. But this image of him was created by his Jewish friends, and in fact, even the earlier part, his success was created by his Jewish friends. And this is an early illustration of the Jewish ethnic networking. He made friends in the right places. He got his books reviewed. He got a publishing contract. He reviewed books for people who later reviewed his books, you know, which is called the log rolling. The whole thing was a PR system, which is not to say his works were not worth reading, but he was certainly successful, and he was successful because of his ethnic network. So there's that aspect of it, and the other aspect is that he was just a normal sort of guy who basically just wanted to be a white Anglo-Saxon German. And had no interest in being some kind of tormented prophet of the Holocaust and so on. This was all created by his friends and his publishers after his death to promote him in the post-war world as this tormented prophet. So I suggest that that if we strip that away. This is two parts. I mean, one is an example of ethnic networking, and the other is to say, well, let's strip that away and let's recuperate Kafka for ourselves. I mean, Kafka wanted to be an Aryan writer, German writer. Let's take him as such. Kafka is our folk comrade. He is one of us. We take him. We take him back. We recuperate him. He's not, you know, the tormented prophet of the Holocaust, but he's a satirical yuppie writer, not unlike Bret Easton Ellis. And that's my suggestion.
Megan Ellis has been somewhat supportive of Trump.
Yes, I think I've heard that. I haven't seen what he's actually written, but
he's not been so open, but it's kind of obvious that he is. I think he tweeted a picture of Trump and called him Daddy. and he was there's this idea that he's been pushing forward called the Trump closet, which is people who are interested in Trump but don't want to speak about him publicly. But, you know, just walking around in my New Jersey town, I see nothing but Trump posters everywhere. So.
You also review the novel A Room in Chelsea Square.
Yes,
which is, it's a gay novel about a wealthy gentleman who lures a younger man into London with the promise of basically the high life.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting novel.
So it's Chelsea in London. I was actually thinking, I've actually been to the Chelsea in London. I've never been to the one in New York, but I know Chelsea in New York is sort of a, associated with gay culture, but it's not about that.
No, it's Chelsea Square in London. I'm not sure if it's exactly has the same reputation. I think it's a higher social level than the New York Chelsea. Not that New York Chelsea is all that low, but I think it's a very somewhat exclusive area.
Well, yeah, I've been there. Definitely is.
But yeah, I mean, there are various aspects of the novel. One thing is I like the publishers very much, Valancourt. I must plug them. They publish a lot of interesting stuff. They publish like ninth forgotten 19th century Gothic novels. And they publish mid-century British fiction like this one. Also in that category is the novels of Colin Wilson, which is might be of more interest to people on the right, the alt-right. So they've been reprinting his novels as well. And also contemporary weird fiction and horror. So they're a very interesting little publisher in Richmond, Virginia. The interest in the Chelsea Square novel, apart from other things I say about it, is that it's a sort of example of what I call camp, what I call wit curdling into camp. What you have in the main character is this sort of decayed version of Oscar Wilde, and this it gets back perhaps to what we were saying in part one about you know the role for people who aren't involved in reproduction in society, and this this is someone who is not really performing any role in society. he exists just to utter, you know, brittle, ironic von Moltz, without much thought behind them. So even the thought behind Oscar Wilde's little bits has dissipated. It's just, you know, and I point out how he thinks of himself as the most interesting person around, but he's actually the most boring. What's interesting about the novel is the way various people extricate themselves from his pernicious influence. So it's sort of a little piece. Valancourt has actually published some more interesting things subsequently that I've also written on Countercurrent that may be in some future publications. But it's sort of a period piece, you know, late 40s, early 50s, sort of gay subculture in London. Nothing's very explicit at all, which is one of the interesting things about it. But contemporary eyes, it's very, very obvious.
And gay culture in New York and London and major cities didn't really, like, become widespread till, like, the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, I would think not. I mean, it's interesting how widespread it was. I mean, that, you know, people seem to be able to locate each other in some strange way. There's a book called Young Man from the Provinces about someone whose name escapes me at the moment, who was supposedly the most beautiful young man in New York in the 1950s. And it's his story of his coming to New York and so on. And you know, it's like at some point he's invited to some cocktail party and the door opens and everyone's there. Noel Coward and Truman Capote and various other people. Like, how do they find each other? Apparently they were all there, right? You could fall into that kind of circuit. So there was this like entire underground culture.
I think it's a myth that the cultural left puts out that the 50s were as oppressive as they say they are towards homosexuals.
Well, I mean, they were officially oppressive, but, you know, I mean, it's hard to tell. I'm still trying to grapple with that. I'm writing a review of a book that I just discovered, although Gore Vidal wrote about this book in a review in a collection that was collected in a collection of his essays that I've had for 20 years. I never read that review until a week. So that's the first time I've heard about this author in this book, which gives you an idea of how forgotten it is. And John Burns Horn. And the book is called The Gallery. It was recently republished by New York Review Book Classic, that little paperback series. When it came out in 1948, it had the reputation of being the greatest novel of the Second World War. And it's been completely forgotten. One of the things I'm trying to grapple with, I'm also reading a recent biography of the author to try and get a handle on this, is exactly how oppressive things were or weren't. Because Burns here was... was never really out of the closet, but he was always like making jokes about having a fiance somewhere or something like that. But when he joined the army and got sent over to Italy, he discovered this whole subculture. Like, the army was full of homosexuals. Forget about this don't ask, don't tell business and so on. And all the homosexuals were trying to get into the army. There were millions of them in the army in the Second World War. They all had their own, they all knew each other, they all had their own culture, they all went to their own clubs, and a great part of the novel takes place in one of these little officers' clubs in Rome, all, you know, off limits, but everyone went there. And it's very interesting, and in his personal life, everyone seemed to know what was going on, but nobody asked any questions or particularly cared. In fact, his problem was he couldn't get a job after he got out of Harvard because he was a Catholic. That was his problem, right? Nobody cared about anything else, but he couldn't get a job as a public school teacher, like one of his fancy New England public schools, because he was a Catholic. So that was the great thing against him. And of course, ironically, of course, as we know, Catholicism and High Church Anglicanism has always been a refuge for homosexuals. Anyway, it's kind of amusing. He was from a Boston Irish working class family, and what they had against him was that he was a working class Catholic. That was the problem with him. I imagine if he had money and was a WASP and so on, no one would have any problems at all. So I'm trying to get a handle on that, but I think it is overblown. I think it's deliberately, like everything else, you would think that people were being lynched every day, in terms of race and so on, in America. What was the situation before the Immigration Act of 65? Obviously, it was more restrictive because that's why we had an Immigration Reform Act, right? But was it, rounding up people in boxcars and taking them to death camps? I don't think so. you know. But when somebody like Trump says, you know, maybe we should enforce the laws we already have, oh, he's a Nazi. There's that level of distortion in the past, you know. I mean, you know, there was good and there was bad, and there was repression and there was not repression. Some things were more oppressive today.
The past was all black and white and
yeah.
a dust bowl, and everyone was starving, and the dad beat the kids, and the mom was crying,
yeah.
and we've been liberated into technicolor, so you can never question this.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean that's, you know, I mean, this is a standard story. I mean, even on the straightforward level, I mean, you were talking before about, you know, the image of the space future. You know? I'm also writing a review of a book about Mystery Science Theater, and they have an interesting chapter about, you know, Mystery Science Theater. Of course, the premise, joke premise, is that they, you know, they've shot into space and they're captive in space and forced to watch these movies. And this is all derived from the movie Silent Running. And interestingly, there are a couple of films that they screened on Mystery Science Theater that involve people trapped in space. One from the 50s, Rocket Ship XM, and one from the 70s, Stranded in Space. It actually won an Academy Award. Well, the point of that is that the people writing the article about this have the standard liberal perspective that the 50s were terrible and the space program was all about militarizing space, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like they're incapable of seeing anything good in the past, is the thing.
I know Jack Donovan, who is sort of the other homosexual figure on the alt-right besides yourself, he has a very different view. His argument is that basically homosexual culture should sort of cease to exist and that homosexuals should adopt sort of a heterosexual version of masculinity and just keep their sort of business on the down low. You disagree with him, you disagree with conservatives, but you also reject sort of the cultural leftist gay identity politics. You have a unique view, but you sort of see in a kind of a cast under a sort of homosexuals playing the role of a sort of cultural elite, sort of the creative cast, like the architects, the artists, creators of culture.
Well, when, like, Oscar Wilde would go on speaking tours in the U.S., wouldn't he just be speaking to, like, a bunch of Riley macho dudes?
Well, that is true, and I, as I have written about in
yes, I stole it from you.
Yeah, stole it from me. Yeah. But and by the way, that also works in with the Speedo business and so on, because Wilde explained that when real men need to do real work, they immediately adopt tight clothing. anyway, the. About Jack Donovan, I've never thought of him as being quite that extreme in his views. And I might also say that everything I say has nothing to do with my own personal inclinations and so on. But the essence of the arguments that I've been making has nothing to do with the sort of like liberal notion of those poor homosexuals and they deserve their rights and so on, which may be true, but it's not what I'm arguing. It's the functions that these people can perform in society. Elaine Denneau talks about how, in Hindu culture, the idea is to look at what's available and how can we make use of it. Whereas our sort of Judeo-Christian sort of culture idea is, find the evil people and exterminate them and then everything will be fine. So the question is, what can these people contribute to society? And I've tried to outline that. And consequently, if we eliminate them or force them underground, then what is society losing? If society would be better off without them, then I say away with them. But I don't think that argument can be made, at least not historically speaking. They have a role to play in society, and that's what I've tried to emphasize. That it's not all about reproduction. Obviously important, but it's not the be-all and end-all of human society. It's not even the be-all and end-all of evolution. James Neal's book, which I have a review on Kindle of, makes that point, that homosexuals, by not bearing children, contribute to the evolutionary success of the human species in various ways. It's not all about carrying on your own genes. It's about the survival of all people's genes.
Would you make the case that one of the reasons that conservatism and right-wing politics have become so anti-intellectual over the past 50 years or so is because they purged the homosexual?
Yeah, essentially. That's why I'm kind of surprised at that presentation of Jack Donovan of his supposed views that he would want them to eliminate them and so on. I mean, that sounds like Daniel Harris, if I might allude to someone. You can look him up on Amazon. Who's an interesting writer, but he seems to have the opinion that homosexuals are valuable when they're suppressed, and but now that they've been liberated, useless. Because by purging it underground, I mean, you're eliminating all of these talented people who obviously now have an interest in supporting your enemies because they're welcomed by your enemies. So it's a lose-lose proposition.
I think it's a vicious cycle because nationalists and traditionalists will see homosexuals teaming up with their enemies, and they'll say, see, these evil homos are out to destroy civilization.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they've joined. Alistair Clark made that point that after Stonewall, gays could have joined up with Western civilization, but instead they joined up with the left's wrecking crew, and it's sort of like a vicious vengeance sort of thing. But here's the thing that I like to point out, that the high point of the American right was at a time when the leading figures of the American right were Roy Cohn, Cardinal Spellman, Whitaker Chambers, and someone whose name unfortunately escapes me at this moment, all more or less well-known homosexuals. So these people were purged, these sorts of people were purged from the movement, and it's no surprise that the movement has become dominated by who? By Jews, by neocons. This is what I write about in the piece called The Judeo as Cuckoo, which was on Occidental Observer and is in the Green Nazis book. The Jew first teaches the Aryan to despise and purge the homosexual, and then the Aryan has no elite. So what does he do? He turns to the Jew. So the Jew functions as a cuckoo, right? And insinuates himself, if the elite was made up of homosexuals, it would be a natural elite of the Aryan people. But instead, we have an alien elite, the Jew. And that's been the bottom line result of Judeo-Christianity, has been to remove the homosexual from public life and replace him with the Jew. And that's exactly what we see.
I saw a commentator on one of those 1488 sites, I forget which one, and it says the alt-right has a new elite of Jews and homosexuals. Like, those two groups are like the same.
Yeah, well, me and James have a secret bonding to take over the alt-right.
just a whole
but
bunch
I mean,
of,
even,
of Milos
even
and Shekels.
Even
Milo Shekelstein is our new totem.
One more thing I'd like to get your thoughts on is a big thing within the alt-right sphere is also it overlaps with the manosphere. And your concept of the Männerbund is where men get together with other men and get their validation from other men. People see the manosphere as being like red pill or subversive, but one thing I've noticed about the manosphere is their belief system is still, they one hand they say, oh, women are all trash, but then they say that men should base their validation from women. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you see, that gets exactly to what I was getting at in Welcome to the Club. You know, the idea that men, that's a good way to express it, that men get their validation from the approval of women. Or, you know, even if you're talking about, you know, the lowest level kind of, you know, scoring with a bunch of chicks, you're getting your validation from women. You're seeking the approval of women. And you know, even if you're gaming them and you're really on top, you're still spending all your time worrying, trying to figure out your game, you know. And then that's the idea that having sex with some new chick is the most important thing in your life. Well, you know, maybe we need a class of people who think that studying Sanskrit or devising a new healthcare system or something like that is the most important thing in their life, not getting laid tonight. And so you know that whole thing, you know, it sounds like it's red pilling because you know they're sort of like, you know, saying, "Yeah, we're sexist pigs and we're proud of it," or something like that. But when you really get down to it, there, you know, this is what I was saying before. You know, the conservatives going back to their childhood or something, no further than that. No real principled opposition to things. So they want to go back to the 50s when, like on Mad Men, you know, men would swan around and pat women secretaries on the butt and so on, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, think about something else for a change.
And these like PUA guys, they have all this knowledge of like evolutionary psychology and the way people think, and they just put it to bullshit.
Yes, massive quantities of carefully, lovingly contrived human knowledge put to this function.
You have to put a penis in a vulva.
That's exactly right, because that we figured out. Everyone knows that, right? What they have is some sort of knowledge that will enable you to do that with a different chick every night. Well, where did that come from? Where did that demand come from? Well, from the idea that you should be boy, you should be girl crazy, right? When you talk about the Manorbund, I mean, you know, those old 30s movies, you know, the Bowery Boys, you know, the Dead End Kids, you know, I mean, just kids, you know, hanging out together, you know, getting into scrapes, you know, they've got a father figure like Bing Crosby or Gabe O'Dell, and who sort of like, or Humphrey Bogart, who leads them in the right direction. You know, they're not looking for chicks, you know, they're not like blacks who are, you know, get their chicks pregnant as soon as they can when they're 15 or something like that, and have 30 different kids with 10 different women and so on. I mean, that's what that produces. You know, these the Bowery Boys aren't out doing that. They're out getting in scrapes. You know, they're having fun. They're learning about the world. They're running a nightclub. They're learning how to build a jalopy. They're doing all kinds of stuff. They're not chasing after chicks. That's for the femmy guy. They like hanging around chicks. You see, that's the whole attitude. In the 30s, someone who thought about chicks all the time and wanted to hang around them and so on was a fag. Right? I mean, think about it, but it makes sense. I mean, why are you interested? That's girl stuff. No? These guys are all fagulas.
Yeah, I guess, you know, one thing that really bothers me about the manosphere culture is kind of what you were getting at a little bit is what they invest all of their time in, because a lot of them are smart and perceptive, but you know they write like 20 books about that's all just like cheesy, like how to, like, you know, basically like marketing, like almost like get rich quick kind of like bullshit. It's like
get laid quick.
I mean,
yeah.
Like write some goddamn poetry or something, you know, like contribute something of cultural value besides these stupid ass how-to books. Like, even if they sell well or whatever, like they're just like I don't find them to be of any value, and it's just a really lack of imagination or any kind of cultural intellectual curiosity or anything like that. Or there's no art in those communities, and it's all ebook marketing bullshit. It's like they're like infomercial people. That's why it's like Don LaPree, you know,
they're very much like
Manosphere.
Well, you know, see, that's the thing, because they have nothing to offer to white, an emerging white culture. Because if you think about it, what they're promoting is negritude, right? You know, you mentioned poetry. I mean, obviously, poetry is for fags. I mean, studying is for fags. Going to the gym, that's for fags. Fags do that. You know, I mean, okay, what are you interested in? Girls, man. You know, how am I going to pick up chicks? Yeah, you know, and, you know, that's the negrification of American society. And these guys are 100% bought into that. I mean, you know, I give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, I think they're misled, but they may think that they're trying to break out of the culture, but they're actually They're like gatekeepers, you know. They like Kunstler, they offer an alternative supposedly, but actually they're hammering down the official story. You know, thou shalt be girl crazy.
That's sort of a real man.
This is what you're doing 24 hours a day, is looking for chicks.
Being a human dildo.
Yeah. That gets back to what I was saying about the evolutionary value of people who aren't doing that all the time. You know? So how shall we wrap this up?
We have to sum up every single thing we talked about.
Buy this book. Buy this book. It's a fine book. It has a wonderful cover by Kevin Slaughter. Magnificent. It'll make you feel like you're in Weimar, Germany. It's very, very retro futuristic.
It's psychedelic and trippy.
Yes.
That's my review.
That's a psychedelic and trippy, exactly. Read this book. And read my other books. Read The Eldritch Evola. Read End of an Era, my analysis of Mad Men. Read Feeling is the Secret, a book that I just put out on Kindle with a special introduction by me, detailing the hermetic and traditionalist roots of the forgotten New Age teacher Neville Goddard, who was the Alan Watts of the 50s. Nobody remembers him. But talk about the 50s, you know, black and white and everyone wearing a suit and tie and all that. Imagine Alan Watts, just like that. And that's Neville Goddard. And Aleister Crowley's secretary said that Neville Goddard was the most magical teacher he had ever encountered. So you should read that book. It's $2.99 on Kindle.
James O'Meara, it's been a great show. Go out and buy his book, Green Nazis in Space. Thanks again for being on, and also thanks, Rabbit and Alex.
Thanks.
Well, thanks you all.
It's been a pleasure,
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Ta-ta.